MacCast, Thursday, January 6th, 2011. Hey, MacGeeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for MacGeeks by MacGeeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back. Brand new year, 2011, kicking things off. And I have to say, Apple started off with a bang. Also, CES is going on. We've got a bunch of things to talk about. It's going to be a feature-packed show. So strap in, hang on, whatever you need to do. We're going to get right into it. But before we get started, I want to take a quick moment and recognize one of our sponsors, Furonix, makers of Deep Freeze. You know, Deep Freeze is a great application if you are in any kind of shared computing environment with your Mac. So if you need to set up a Mac and you're going to put it in a location where other people are going to be using it, other people are going to have access to it, but you don't have to worry about anything bad happening to the operating system, someone getting there, messing with something, trashing things out of the system folder, and basically rendering the machine unusable, so you have to keep coming back and resetting it up and rebuilding it. Deep Freeze takes away all that worry, because what you can do is you can set up the system, load the applications, get it all ready to deploy, and then you run Deep Freeze on it. And once you've done that, you've locked down that configuration. It is set in stone. Then you can deploy that system. Your users can get in there and use it. You can set up something that Deep Freeze calls thaw spaces, which are persistent areas of storage, and you define those. It can even be something like the entire user folder if you're setting up multiple users. It's real easy to set up and do. And that way, users can save documents. They can put stuff there. It's going to stay. But the areas that you've frozen with Deep Freeze, you've locked in place, anything that's done to those areas, it can still be done depending on how you have it set up. A user could go in there and say, delete something out of the library folder if you allow that. But you reboot the system, and because you installed Deep Freeze, it is going to reset everything back in those frozen spaces to the exact state as when you deployed that system. And that reboot could even be initiated remotely. So if you've got a lot of machines that you manage, it's going to save you time. You're not going to have to run out to every system to put it back into a workable state. You can just use something like Apple's Remote Desktop, which it has full integration for. So a really great product. It's used by schools and government organizations and hotels. You can get full information and details on the Furonix website, furonix.com. There's also trials available. Check it out. And a big thank you to Furonix for their support of the MacCast. So as I sit here recording this episode, it is Thursday, January 6th. And as promised, Apple did release the new Mac App Store for Mac OS X as part of a Mac OS X update, Mac OS X 10.6.6. You can grab it via the software update utility. They also have the full combo installers available on Apple support website at apple.com/support. We're going to get to the App Store stuff here in a second, but beyond the App Store, it included a couple other updates and fixes. It addressed a cropping issue with some PostScript printing in the landscape orientation, and also resolved an issue with some Macs where the mouse pointer movement was erratic if you were connected to an external DVI display. That's if you had the ATI graphics card. So some graphics drivers updates. And I think I saw over on Mac Observer that there was one security update, although when I had looked into it earlier, I didn't notice that one. But I guess there's a security patch or fix in there as well. So you'll want to grab the update for those things. But the big feature that is in 10.6.6 is the new Mac App Store, something that Steve Jobs announced at WWDC over the summer. It's going to be integrated and part of Mac OS X 10.7 Lion. But Apple didn't want to wait on the feature till then to give it to us and developers and things like that. They have a pretty good financial incentive to not wait. They're going to be taking 30% of every sale, just like they do on the iOS App Store. But they put it out today, and we have our first look at it and kind of first impressions and stuff like that. So I grabbed the update first thing this morning when I woke up, and it was, you know, pretty easy. Ran software update, it downloaded the update, did a typical reboot, and when it restarted, there was a brand new App Store icon in my dock. And I'm a little bit sensitive about my dock. I don't like things being stuck in there, but I kind of understand why it needs to do that so that it's obvious that this new feature is there, because that's really the only indication, the only visual indication after you run the update that the App Store has been installed. The other way to access the App Store is Apple changed the macOS 10 software link that was under the Apple menu. That was sort of promised. We knew that that link was going away and that eventually probably Apple is going to remove the website that's associated with that. If you go to apple.com/downloads/macOS X right now, or macOS 10 right now, there is a software page up there that's supposedly going away and is going to be replaced ultimately by the App Store. No real timeline was given on when that might happen, but the change is coming. And now if you go under the Apple menu with 10.6.6 installed, what you see is an App Store link. So that's the other way that you can launch the App Store if you want to remove it from your dock. And it's a simple enough process to remove it from the dock. Just drag it out of there and it won't be in there anymore if you don't like it taking up that extra space. But the app is there. You launch it. It looks very similar to any kind of other App Store app running on an iOS device, specifically the iPad. You've got a couple tabs along the top, the featured top charts, different categories. Apple was able to populate it up front with about 1,000 apps. So there's no shortage of applications available on launch day. I think they did a pretty good job of prepping developers, which is one of the reasons why they announced it at WWDC and told developers to get their apps ready. You can launch the application and access the store, browse through, search for things, all just by running the app. But when you actually want to download something, and there's both free and paid apps available, when you want to download a new app, you do need to log in using your Apple ID. So Apple ID could be, if you have a MobileMe account or an iTunes account already, it would be that ID, or you can sign up for a new Apple ID if you don't have one already, although I can't imagine any Mac user who doesn't have an Apple ID, because it's pretty much required for everything these days, especially if you have any kind of iOS device. When you do log in, it is going to give you an updated terms and conditions. I haven't been able to figure out yet what has exactly changed. I think mostly you're just agreeing to the new terms and conditions that exist for the App Store. There were a couple reports early on that people were getting an error 100 occasionally when trying to log in for the first time. The things that I've been reading is that it may be related to the updated terms and conditions or changes to the account system. And most of the time you can fix it by simply either quitting and relaunching the App Store app, or in some cases people are reporting having to quit iTunes or go into iTunes under their App Store account and actually log out and quit iTunes. As a last resort, I guess, a fix is to totally reboot the Mac, and that seems to clear things up. But just a couple of reports of people having some login issues or issues getting into their Apple ID. I would imagine another thing to check, although I haven't heard reports of this being a problem, but another thing to check might be if you have a saved credit card on file, making sure that the credit card information is up to date and that the expiration date isn't, you know, it hasn't expired or something like that. It might be worth checking into if you're having these kinds of issues. As far as integration with the operating system, it had been reported by 9to5 Mac before the App Store was released that there would be some pretty tight integration with the operating system. One of the things mentioned I tested out is that if you have a document that you receive that has an unknown extension, or if the operating system doesn't know how to open it, you get that dialog box that pops up normally and asks you to go find an application to open that file with. There's now an additional button on there that says, would you like to search the App Store to find a compatible app for this file type? So you can click that button. That'll launch the App Store and go out and look for an application, which is going to be a nice feature for people who receive email attachments and occasionally get maybe a file format that they can't open, something that's in a compressed format that's not natively supported. You can actually go out and find an application that might be able to help you open or read that document. So I think it's going to be an advantage to have that kind of tight integration. As far as my first impressions, I immediately, you know, launched the application. I knew that a new version of the Tweety app was coming out for the Mac along with the App Store that had been rumored before the announcement, and it was right there on the front page. And Tweety is now, it was purchased by Twitter, so it's the new Twitter app for the Mac, and I downloaded that. When you actually click an item to download it after logging into your account, there's a really kind of neat animation. It might get old after a while, but basically the app icon jumps from the application down to your dock, and then you get the little loading progress bar, very similar to the download progress bars you see on the icons in the iOS apps. So you get a progress bar showing you that it's downloading. Now, once it's finished downloading, it does leave the application icon in the dock and sets the keep in dock parameter to on. I'm not sure how I feel about that because I'm pretty strict about what I want to have in my dock. And unfortunately, I thought, well, there must be a setting to say, you know, don't download applications into the dock or don't keep them in the dock. And when I went to the app settings or the settings for the App Store, the Mac App Store, they were completely blank. So I don't know if Apple's still working on them or what have you. The other weird thing is it doesn't have a standard system preference. So my first thought was to go under the Apple menu and look for a preferences, or the application menu, excuse me, and look for a preferences option. That wasn't there. You actually have to go in like you do with the iTunes store and go to kind of, it's in the app, but to me it still just feels like a web page of the settings, but the settings are blank, so there's nothing you can really configure yet. Some of the things about the App Store like that are feeling a little bit beta-ish, like it's feeling like a beta build, even though Apple's not officially calling that. But I have a feeling a lot like the original application store on the iOS or App Store on the iOS devices, there's going to be a lot of growth and changes based on feedback that people give Apple. So I have a feeling we all should be using the apple.com/feedback address to give them our thoughts and opinions. I'm going to mention something about not leaving the applications in the dock. Again, it's easy to remove that application once it's downloaded from the dock. Just simply drag it out of the dock and it's not going to be there anymore. But I'd prefer to have the option because the applications also, as they should, install right into your applications folder where they would normally go if you were, you know, just dragging them in there yourself. But another nice feature, I guess, of having a Mac App Store and having the install process happen like this is you don't have to mount the disk image. You don't have to, you know, drag the application over or run an installer. That all happens automatically, and then you don't have that cleanup of unmounting that disk image and doing all those sorts of things, which confuses some new users to the Mac who aren't used to that kind of install process. So it does kind of make everything a little bit more seamless. Another big feature of this is that application updates are going to happen from the Mac App Store. Now, some people had thought that it might be integrated into the software update and system preferences. That's actually not the case. To update your applications, you do need to launch the App Store application, and then there is an updates tab, and you click on the updates tab and it'll show you all of the applications that have updates available for them. And then I haven't seen how that process works yet because all the apps that are in the App Store are new right now, but I would imagine it's going to happen very similarly to the way it does on iOS devices, where you simply click a single button and you can update all the applications all at once or choose individual applications to go in and update. Now, as far as applications that you had installed prior to the App Store update, it will see that you have applications installed as you're browsing through the App Store. And this particularly works well right out of the box for any of the iLife applications or iWork applications. It'll see that you have those installed, and rather than showing you a price or other options, the button where normally it would say buy or download says installed. Now, this didn't work for every application that I had already installed on my Mac, but what I discovered was that a lot of the developers pushed out new updates today for their applications. So what I had to do is actually go to the website for each particular app, make sure I was up to date, or just simply launch that application and do a check for updates, make sure it was already up to date on my Mac, and then quit and relaunch the Mac App Store. And then in most cases, actually, in all cases for me, I've been reading different reports online. Some people have found this to be hit or miss. But for myself, if I would run the update on the application and then relaunch the Mac App Store, it would recognize that that app was installed and show me as I was browsing that the application was already installed on my Mac. So if you've run into that trouble, that's something to try. Again, another fix that I've been reading online is to just simply restart your Mac and then restart the Mac App Store, and then it'll start to recognize those applications that you had installed. But I think the version numbers need to be exactly the same. So if you're running, you know, 2.4.3 and the application's been updated to 2.4.4, and that's the version that's in the Mac App Store, it's not going to recognize that you have the application installed on your computer. So it's pretty literal. So make sure you're, you know, you have version parity before that feature starts working. And Cult of Mac found something interesting about uninstalling applications. Most of us are used to just simply being able to drag an application to the trash. If you're using a standard user account, it's going to prompt you for your admin username and password before you can trash the application and uninstall it. If you're running an admin account, though, typically it just goes in the trash, you empty the trash, and then the application is quote-unquote uninstalled, right? Well, according to Cult of Mac, now with the Mac App Store, any applications installed that way are going to require, when you move them to the trash, that you authenticate using an admin account. And that's even if you're already logged into an admin account. And I tried this on my own system, and it turned out to be the case. As to why it's happening, it looks like because an Apple application is actually installing the app, it's setting the permissions or the user and the group in macOS 10 to a root user in the group wheel. And if you don't know what that means, that's Unix stuff. If you do, this is mainly for the techie people out there. It's giving it that permissions. And those are the same owner and group permissions that are assigned to the Apple installed applications. Prior to this update, or prior to apps being installed via the Mac App Store, typically it would assign the owner as either the admin account, or I think in almost all cases as the admin account, and the group as either staff if you were installing under a user account and just authenticated using the admin credentials, or it would be installed with the group admin. And in all those cases, then the admin user would have permissions, would have write permissions on those files, and that's why you could trash them without authenticating. So I think that's what's going on with the change. I still need to investigate it a little bit further, but that's my consensus at this point. Another thing to note is that pricing on the new Mac App Store seems to be kind of all over the place. I think there's going to be a lot of experimentation on pricing from the developers. One thing that I'm hoping we're not going to see is the same sort of race to the bottom pricing that we saw on the iOS App Store, but I have a feeling that that might ultimately end up having as developers sort of jockey for position and try and get their apps higher ranked so they can get a little bit of exposure. It probably won't be a problem so much early on because there's only about 1,000 apps in there now, but as the number of applications grow, I think we might see some of that behavior. Apple did kind of kick things off in that race to the bottom pricing because they did lower pricing significantly on a couple of applications. So if you've been holding off to get Aperture 3 from Apple, it's $79.99 on the new App Store. That's down from the original price of $199. And also Apple Remote Desktop, which is really great software if you need to remotely administer Macs. It's typically used in the IT world. It's $79.99 as well, and it was $299 before. So great deals there. And as was predicted, all of the iLife and iWork apps are now available as individual applications through the App Store. The iLife apps are $14.99 each. So that's iPhoto, GarageBand, and iMovie. They don't include iWeb or iDVD, so I'm not really sure what we read into that. Those were the two apps that weren't updated in the latest iLife 11 update. And then the iWork apps are $19.99 each, and I think that's going to be a really popular option. So if you just need Pages, you can pick it up for $20. And you note, if you add the pricing up on the individual apps, those are discounts from the original bundled versions that you can pick up at the Apple retail store. As far as pricing on third-party apps, again, we're kind of seeing it all over the board. There's a lot of apps that are being ported over from the iOS devices, especially a lot of games, Angry Birds, things like that. They're very popular, and the pricing has sort of been maintained from the iOS versions to the desktop versions, which, again, I think undercuts the price. It sets that pricing level pretty low on games. It's going to be great for us. Don't get me wrong. As a user, I think it's great. I just ultimately worry about the viability of having developers develop for the Mac platform and have them be able to make a living off of their applications without having to sell like millions of versions of an app. So really popular apps, I think, can survive at that lower pricing. But the more specialty apps, things like that, I think are going to continue to need to be more niche priced and have niche pricing on them. But Pixelmator, for example, came out on the Mac App Store, and it's $29.99, whereas if you go online to their website and buy it right now, it's $59.99. So you're almost $30 off there. Other applications seem to have maintained their pricing in the move from the web or other distribution models to the Mac App Store. So we'll have to kind of see how it all plays out. And if you have any thoughts or opinions on that, I'd love to hear from you. Licensing on the Mac App Store. This is another thing that I think is great for us as users, but I have some concerns about for the developers. Basically, if you download an application from the Mac App Store, the license is for any Mac that you own and you control. So you can use the same account to download that app and put it on any Mac that you own. This is very similar to the model that we're used to with iOS devices, and Apple's continuing that with the Mac App Store. As far as how it works from the developer's perspective, it does tie that authentication to your Apple ID. So you will need to, on each Mac that you own, connect to the App Store and log in with that Apple ID. And that's sort of what controls the licensing. As long as, it turns out, the developer has implemented that licensing within their application or support for that licensing, there's actually APIs that they have to tie into, and it's come out that some of the app developers apparently didn't see that or didn't care because some apps are not checking, and therefore you can take those applications and put them on other Macs that aren't logged in with that ID and even put them onto Macs running Leopard and some of the other operating systems, and it apparently doesn't seem to be doing that check. I guess in essence what it does is it does lock your purchases, or it checks your purchases against the Mac UUID, which is a hardware unique identifier that Apple uses. That feature is something that is very similar to how it works with iOS devices again. So I think we're seeing a lot of this sort of back to the Mac stuff that Apple talked about, and that we'll see more of when OS 10.7 Lion comes out this summer. Overall, the App Store looks like it's going to be a really nice feature. It's nicely integrated. It does feel a little bit beta. I don't know if I'd say that it's rushed, because it does have some pretty good polish behind it, but I think there's a lot more features to come, and we're going to have to see what happens with a number of things like the pricing, how apps are promoted, and how people get access to them. But I think as a concept, as something that is going to make it a lot easier for people to find and discover and download, install, and manage their applications, I think it is going to be a really nice and appreciated addition to the operating system. I'd love to get your thoughts and opinions on the new Mac App Store, what applications you're enjoying, if you like the process, any concerns that you might have. I certainly have some of my own. Share your thoughts and ideas. You can send your email to maccast@gmail.com or call in on the listener hotline. I'll have information at the end of the show on just how to do that. So Mac App Store is probably the biggest story this week. We've actually got a couple of weeks of stories to cover, because last episode I brought you a special episode. We didn't cover much news. One of those stories that's a holdover from a couple weeks ago is the CDMA iPhone, and we're actually getting more rumors about that with CES happening this week, that Apple is set to release a CDMA iPhone probably in the first quarter. The rumors seem to be getting hotter and hotter that it'll happen in Q1 of 2010. A couple weeks ago, DigiTimes reported that Apple had upped its quarter one iPhone orders to about 20 to 21 million units, and they claim that 5 to 6 million of those units would be CDMA models destined for the U.S. and the Asia-Pacific regions. China is another big area where they would be using CDMA technology for iPhones. We do have to consider the source anytime it's coming from DigiTimes. They've been hit or miss. They generally keep on top of Apple's suppliers and the components going in to make the different devices. So we never really know what's going to happen with their rumors. Also, Apple's fourth quarter numbers for this year are estimated to be at about 15.5 million units. So I think if Apple thinks they're going to sell the same number of GSM or GSM phones in the first quarter, and then you tack on those 5 to 6 million CDMA units, I can see getting to that 20 million number. But you would think that GSM sales on iPhones would slow down a little bit. So it seems a little bit aggressive to me. Maybe there would be a bump up in the marketing, though, because the announcement of a CDMA iPhone or an iPhone on Verizon could just jump the numbers. And actually, the more I think about it, I really believe the announcement wouldn't just be the iPhone coming to Verizon, but an overall opening up of the iPhone to all carriers within the U.S. who would carry it. So in essence, we probably could see it on T-Mobile and even potentially Sprint at the same time. And by adding that much more of a market to sell to, maybe Apple could sell 20 to 21 million units in the quarter. Related to that, this week there's an unconfirmed report that Apple retail stores in the States are freezing vacation requests for their employees for about 3 weeks beginning at the end of January. This report came out of Boy Genius Report, and Apple has historically done that when they have a big product launch or announcement coming out. They'll tell employees that they can't take vacations, that they need to be in store. I would imagine there'd be some considerable training and stuff that needs to happen to support the launch of an iPhone on Verizon. So there could be some validation of the CDMA iPhone rumors if this other rumor is true. And also this week we saw, or actually tomorrow, we're going to see a price drop on the iPhone in the U.S., the iPhone 3GS, down to $49, both by Apple and AT&T. That was announced. So another indicator that new devices are coming, or a new device is coming, is something like a price drop on older models. I would imagine also it might be a tactic by AT&T to try and get some new subscribers in advance of a Verizon model coming out, because it does require a two-year contract, so they could lock some iPhone owners in, preventing them from actually switching and getting the iPhone should it come to Verizon. So all those things happening, and then we turn around, and guess what? There's a leaked video of some supposed parts. Nobody really knows if it's for a Verizon iPhone or for an iPhone 5. There were a couple sources that this came out of, and adding further fuel to the fire, the video that was posted was reportedly ordered to be taken down from YouTube by Apple. So that usually validates these videos. It almost seems better that Apple, it would almost seem better for Apple to leave those videos posted, because then people tend to not believe them or think they're faked or whatnot. But in case you haven't seen the video, it is supposedly of a new iPhone mid-plate. And the mid-plate is kind of the main component. It's what everything attaches and bolts onto, and it includes the metal band that is the antenna. And there's some significant changes. Actually, the most significant changes noted in the video are on that band, specifically that the little antenna separation lines that on the current iPhone are on the top. There's one on the top kind of near the headphone jack. That's been moved to the side on this new supposed iPhone, Verizon iPhone or iPhone 5 mid-plate. And the general consensus or thought online was that that is to correct or adjust for some of the antenna attenuation issues that the current model has. Also, internally, just above the home button, one of the videos notes that there is also another little wire or separation in the area down there that might also be to deal with some of the antenna issues. I have to wonder, too, if it is a CDMA version, if it does turn out to be this is the new CDMA component, that there might just be some different antennas and different things that Apple needs to hook up. So there's certainly going to be design changes. Other things to note in the video are just moving of certain places where components bolt on, some longer lead cables and stuff for different components because they've shifted things around, stuff like that. So I know we've been hearing a lot about the CDMA iPhone and the iPhone coming to Verizon. I think finally, really, despite the fact that everything feels still like a lot of rumor and conjecture and stuff like that, I think all of the stars are aligning. Things are really heating up. We're getting a lot more of these reports. We're hearing a lot more about these components and seeing videos like this that are being ordered to take down. I think we are getting very close to Apple opening things up here in the States for different carriers to carry the iPhone. And it would not surprise me if Verizon is a big announcement in the next few months. I never thought it would happen, but the day might finally be here. And of course, we can't let the iPhone have all of the rumor fun. There's plenty of second generation iPad rumors. We're hearing a lot coming out of CES. I think something like 80 tablets being announced at CES, most of them not even shipping any time at the beginning of this year, a lot of them later in the year. Probably the one that's getting the most buzz is the new tablet from Motorola. I think it's the Zoom X, you know, spelled with an X because they're clever. That one seems to be getting a good buzz and is supposed to be out in the first quarter, but Apple may beat them to the punch. I would expect a new iPad announcement from Apple probably toward the end of February, maybe early March, and then shipping in the April timeframe. As far as what might be getting upgraded, well, the processor for one, Rodman Renshaw analyst Ashok Kumar says it's likely to be a dual-core processor based on an ARM Cortex A9 design, probably a 1 gigahertz, but a dual-core, which would be a bump up from the current A4 chip, which uses an ARM Cortex A8 design, if memory serves me properly, and would bring the next-gen tablet in line with the tablets announced by Motorola and BlackBerry. The BlackBerry Playbook is also getting a little bit of buzz at CES. Dual cores would bring better performance, especially in the area of multitasking, but as Jeff Gamet, who I do the iPhone Alley podcast with and is also a contributing editor or editor over at Mac Observer, he says that, you know, it could negatively affect battery life. So he kind of questions a little bit whether Apple will go with a dual core processor. Both Motorola and BlackBerry say their battery life is going to be in line with the current generation iPad, something like 10 hours with heavy video usage. So if Apple can maintain that and still bump up the processor, I think they likely would. CDMA support is also being rumored from, again, DigiTimes, so consider the source, but that would likely happen. Verizon's been kind of hinting at the fact that they might have iPads for sale in the future. Little slips here and there seem to be potentially indicating that. Again, all of this stuff is really just rumored. We also have been seeing some early case designs, iPad 2 cases, believe it or not. And this typically happens before any new iOS device comes out. The case manufacturers in China, Korea, and places like that start putting out cases. I think a lot of it is just stuff that they're speculating on. They look at the rumors and they kind of build these cases to spec. I'm not 100% convinced they have insider information from Apple, but one of them did surface at CES this week, and supposedly the new iPad is going to have a better speaker system, redesigned speakers that have been moved kind of to the back, also front and potentially front-facing and potentially rear-facing camera. So we're seeing some cases with some camera holes. I think it's probably pretty good odds that there's going to be a FaceTime camera built into the new iPad. I'm not so sure about the rear-facing camera. I still think it would just be rather odd to hold up something sized, you know, at the size of an iPad to actually take photos. But a lot of the other tablets are going to have front and rear-facing cameras, so Apple might just throw that in there to compete. Going to be thinner, more tapered on the bezel. There's also been some indication that it might be a more squarish design like the current iPhone 4. So I don't know how that translates. You know, a flat back, but thinner bezel and tapered edges is, I guess, how you would describe it or how it's being described. And then lastly, a bump up in the memory from the 256 megabytes that's in the current model to 512 megabytes of RAM, so doubling the RAM in the iPad. Again, that seems like a likely and very logical upgrade for the next generation iPad. But a lot of you have been asking me, when should I buy an iPad now? Should I wait? At this point, I would say you probably want to wait. Probably going to, like I said, get an announcement here in about a month or so. Cool little story about a guy who's been hacking away at the latest generation of the iPod Nano, the sixth generation iPod Nano. iLounge had a story about James Welton, who runs a site called nanohack.me, and he's been working on getting past some of the device cache comparison routines and was able to do it, and it allowed him to actually remove one of the application icons from the iPod Nano. So that's kind of the first or early steps into getting the device actually jailbroken. It's not an actual jailbreak yet. The developer pointed that out on his blog a couple weeks ago, but he has been able to boot the iPod with some modified files and was able to remove that icon, replacing it with a blank space on the springboard. And anybody who doesn't know, the springboard is generally what everybody refers to as the application launcher that you see on an iOS device or a device like the iPod Nano. The iPod Nano, just for clarification, doesn't run iOS, it actually runs a updated or modified version of the iPod OS that looks very much like the iOS. It's a little bit confusing. So it's a whole different kind of hack. He's working on it. If you want to follow his progress, you can check out his website, nanohack.me. Another interesting story that happened, I think, a couple weeks ago is a report that, you know, the iOS supports a lot of languages. I think over 50 languages currently. There was an update that actually came as part of the 4.1 update that probably a lot of people missed, because there's only about probably only about 8,000 people that it really applies to, and that is Apple worked with the Cherokee Nation to add Cherokee language support into iOS. So you can actually type in Cherokee on your iPhone if you want to enable the feature. If you go into language settings, you'll see it there. There's about 290,000 members in the Cherokee Nation tribe right now, and only about 8,000 of them actually speak the native dialect, but they're trying to preserve their language. And so they went to Apple and they asked if Apple would be willing to help with it, because the theory is that a lot of their young people are using this technology, and they think if devices like the iPhone and the iPod Touch that their young people are using support the language, they're more likely to be willing to learn it and adopt it. And I think that makes a lot of sense. So it was great to see that Apple worked with them on that, and then that feature was added, and it got a little bit of news coverage a couple weeks ago. So I just thought that was a great little story. Apple quietly added another feature update to its support website. Something they're calling Support Profiles allows you to go onto your support account, and you can now view all of your products, everything that you've registered. You can see the repair history of those, and you can easily find and search for self-service articles to kind of help you out with troubleshooting your system. You're also able to go in there and add your phone number and for SMS. If you want Apple to be able to text you, I'm not really sure if we'd all want that, but you know, some people prefer, that's their preferred method of communication. They like that over email. So you do have that option. You can throw in your numbers. And the other thing that they added that is kind of neat is when you register your products now, you can actually assign nicknames to them, something a little bit more meaningful to you, so that when you go in and you're looking at the different products and looking up the repair histories, you can see that by a nickname. So if you haven't checked that out, I think that goes along with a lot of the other updates that Apple's been making to the support website. One of my favorites is the new Express Lane support service, which allows you to go in and set up a call. So if you're having trouble with your Mac, if you need some AppleCare support, you can go in there, you can use the Express Lane service and say, call me tomorrow at 3 o'clock. And they do a great job. They call you right back, and you don't have to wait on hold or anything like that. So it's kind of almost a reverse support call, and I really like that. And Apple's been making a lot of updates to their support website, making it easier to use. I think they updated some things in the forums. If you haven't been over there, you should probably check it out, apple.com/support. It's becoming a better and better resource for doing self-service support and getting just information about your products and stuff like that. Intel took advantage of CES to make an announcement about its new chips. We'd been kind of hearing about the new Sandy Bridge processors. That's the code name for Intel's next generation Core 2 Duo designs. They actually announced 29 different chips running up to, they say, 800% faster than the current generation of Core 2 Duo designs, 60% faster than the current Core i7 chips in the iMac. Now, Intel might be slightly overstating their numbers. I think we're getting marketing numbers from Intel. I kind of did some poking around some of the performance websites online, and it seems to be about a 10 to 50% real-world performance improvement bump over the current generation processors, depending on, you know, what you're starting with and what you're going to. If you're kind of comparing, you know, the current version to the next gen version at the same level of the processor line, that's when you're seeing 10 to 50%. You know, obviously, if you took the bottom of the line current processor and compared it to the top of the line new one, I think that's where they're coming up with that 800% number. But the key features of the new processors is they're four core designs, and they're integrated with an on die GPU. So that is an integrated graphics processor, but on the same die, meaning a lot of the latency and performance issues that you typically have with integrated GPUs are being overcome, and so you're getting better performance. There's a lot of rumors that Apple may be switching back to some of the integrated GPU designs with the next generation Intel processors. So they had kind of moved away from those and were using some of the NVIDIA GPUs, even in the even in things like the MacBooks and lower-end MacBook Pros. And the new Intel chips use a 32-nanometer design, meaning that they should literally just like sip power and have better heat performance than the current generation processors. So expect those probably across the board, I would imagine, in iMacs, MacBooks, MacBook Pros, with the integrated GPUs being used in the base to mid-range models and probably dedicated GPUs. Some rumors that Apple may be moving back to ATI. ATI is getting some good buzz on their new graphics processors, maybe in the higher end models in the future. Just prior to releasing the macOS 10.6.6 update, Apple did also update some of the iLife and iWork applications. GarageBand 6.0.1 was released. It includes overall stability and compatibility fixes, along with addressing a number of other minor issues. According to the release notes, it fixes an issue related to undoing time flex edits, removes an occasional latency problem that could occur on guitar tracks, and restores the ability to use the quantize note timing menu for tracks with groove matching. That last one, I have no idea what that is. All of these seem to be more related to musicians. If you use any of these features, maybe explain some of them to me. I welcome your email, maccast@gmail.com. Apple also updated iMovie to version 9.0.1. It improves stability and fixes a number of minor issues, including an issue where stabilization could not be applied correctly to some video clips from the iPhone or the iPod Touch, a fix to an issue that prevented the use of Facebook passwords that contained non-numeric characters. So if you're using those secure passwords that I always tell you to use, you might not have been able to use that Facebook feature in iMovie. That should be fixed now. Improves compatibility with some cameras that create content in multiple formats, and also improves the performance when scrolling through the project library. So if you're an iMovie user, you probably want to grab that update. And then finally, iWork 9.0.5 was released. It adds support for playback of keynote presentations on iWork.com's public beta. Does anybody use iWork.com? I don't know many people that do. I'm sure there's people out there that do. This is a nice update because I don't think you could share keynote presentations on iWork.com yet. Also included support for 15 animations and effects, so you don't lose those when posting to iWork.com, as long as the person viewing is using the latest version of Safari. Also added support for Keynote Remote 1.2, which is an update to the remote application if you use that, and now includes the ability to use high-resolution slides that support the Retina display. Addresses an issue with the keynote and ruler numbers when moving and resizing a shape or scrolling. Addressed an issue when exporting keynote presentations to iTunes and the iPod when using iTunes 10. Improves the readability of EPUB documents exported from the Pages application, which a lot of people, I think, don't know that Pages can now export EPUB formats, which means that you could sync them over to iBooks. So if you have Pages documents, you might look into that functionality. I need to play around with that a little bit more. And includes public sharing and private upload document sharing options for iWork.com, which is a nice addition, and that's supported across Keynote Pages and Numbers. So maybe iWork.com's going to be a little bit more even useful now with this update. So if you haven't picked up any of those, you can run your software update utility through the system preferences or just head over to apple.com/support. And then finally in the news this week, it looks like Sony is playing around with some of the iTunes Extras stuff. That's the functionality that allows iTunes movie downloads to actually have DVD-like extras and functions and stuff like that. Typically, with iTunes, you either get the same features as the DVD release or less. In this case, Sony has at least three titles in the iTunes store that they haven't really announced or promoted, but it came out this week, that have extras that are exclusive to iTunes. The films are The Other Guys, Salt, and Resident Evil Afterlife. One of the ones that I'm most kind of interested in is the ability to search the entire script for specific excerpts of dialogue. So you can, you know, find that quote directly in the iTunes movie. And then also they have direct sharing of selected clips for social media sites and the ability to add a soundtrack playlist to iTunes that would let you preview audio files from the soundtrack or music files from the soundtrack, Previews only, though, it actually then links you over to the iTunes store if you want to actually make purchases. So the last two items are more marketing items. The first one sounds like a true extra to me, but interesting to see them doing that. And actually, on the clip sharing part, that's a little bit progressive. A lot of the studios are always trying to shut down clip sharing online. So the fact that they're promoting it and allowing you to do it through an iTunes extra feature is somewhat significant, I guess. I'd be curious to know if any of you have tried the iTunes extra download. I think for me, until they actually start offering better pricing and some way to fix the long-term storage issues for direct digital downloads, I'm still not sold on buying them. I prefer to just go get the DVD or the Blu-ray with the extras, because then I have that hard copy. It's almost like having a backup if I don't want to have it stored on my computer, taking up, you know, several gigs of storage. I don't have to do that. I have another option. I really hope that Apple and the studios work out some sort of cloud deal where I can re-download movies. If I was able to do that, I might be more likely to buy them online, especially now that they're bumping up these extra features, because that was my argument in the past, was I always wanted the DVD extras and those weren't included. But now with iTunes extras, we do actually have that option. So that'll do it for the news for this week. As I mentioned, CES is in full swing, and beyond the 80 tablet competitors and the iPad 2 cases and the iPhone cases and the iPod watch bands and all that other stuff that we're seeing tons and tons of stuff pouring out of CES with, I did find kind of two exciting things, or two things that I'm excited about that are related to the Mac and the iOS. The first is that we are starting to see, finally, iPod dock connected hardware and software integration. This was something that was announced as part of iPhone OS 3. Yes, I said iPhone OS. So this is prior to even Apple rebranding the iPhone OS as iOS, that developers were going to have the ability to build iPhone accessories that connected to the dock connector, and they would be able to, through the software APIs, communicate between the hardware device and the software. And there were a couple interesting things shown off, and I believe one of them was a medical, like blood pressure, I think it was actually a glucose monitor. We haven't seen that, but two companies announced that they are going to have blood pressure monitors that will integrate with an iPhone application and be connected through the dock connector. So I thought that was pretty cool. Y-Things is one of them. They make the Y-Things scale. If you've seen that before, that's a scale that can actually connect to your internet connection. And I don't know why you'd want to do this, but it would tweet out your weight every morning. I guess if you need that kind of pressure on you to lose weight, you can do that. But the Y-Things blood pressure monitor connects to your iPod. It's a little cuff or your iPhone or your iOS device, and then comes with software, and you can monitor and track your blood pressure. So I thought that was pretty cool. Also, a company called iHealth, has a similar product. And then just this morning, there was a company called, I think it's Tivizen, T-I-V-I-Z-E-N, Tivizen, maybe it's Tivizen. They announced an over-the-air television receiver, digital TV receiver, that hooks up to your iOS device, and then you can receive a TV signal. So it looks like a little antenna that hangs off of a iPod dock connector. Plug that into the bottom of your device, download their app, and then you can get free over-the-air TV signals directly to your iPhone, your iPad, or iPod Touch. And I thought that was pretty cool, and I have a feeling we're going to be seeing a lot more of these devices. So I don't know what changes went on at Apple, if all of these are Apple-approved and licensed devices. I would assume they are, because Apple has been shutting down different companies, specifically most recently HyperMac, the makers of the batteries, companies that don't officially license or get Apple's blessing on using the iPod dock connector. So I expect more hardware to be coming out. The other big sort of product category, Mac-related, that we're seeing coming out of CES, at least from the consumer electronics side, is a bunch of speaker products and audio products that are supporting Apple's AirPlay technology. We kind of knew that was going to be coming, but we're finally seeing those products from companies like iHome, Bowers & Wilkins, JBL, and some of the others that were announced earlier at the after the iOS announcement. I guess since we've had the last couple shows that we covered, well, we always cover backup on the show, but been more heavily involved in backup. And I think it's a good thing to think about this time of year. You know, as we've gotten to the end of the year, you're starting a new year. It's a good time to, if you haven't already done it, set up backup. So I've been receiving some questions related to some of the conversations that we've been having. One of them was a number of you wanted to know about encrypting your Time Machine backups. So securing your data within the Time Machine backups, does Time Machine even support the encryption? What's going on there? I looked into this a little bit. I personally use mainly just encrypted disk images. We've talked about this on the show in the past to protect specific areas of content. But if you're kind of encrypting your whole disk or wanting to encrypt large portions of your disk, there's a couple different ways you can do it within Time Machine, or to do it in a way that Time Machine supports. One of them is to use sparse images instead of just standard volumes. And it's a little bit tricky to set up. You kind of need to do some terminal coding mojo if you kind of want to automate the process. There's actually a really good article at a blog called The Practice of Code. I will have a link to it in the show notes. It goes into great detail on how to set up encrypted sparse disk images to do and support Time Machine backups if you want to dive into that. Another route to go is to use a product from now Symantec, but it used to be it's still PGP. It's PGP whole disk encryption. And I have a number of friends, I think including Victor Cahiao of the Typical Mac User Podcast, who swear by and use PGP whole disk encryption on their MacBooks. And it does have support, or has full support for Time Machine, so you can use it along with Time Machine. And then there's also Apple's built-in technology, the File Vault technology. I have never been a big fan of it because early on it had a lot of issues. I know people who use it now and say that it's been fixed and they use it, and they use it reliably. So if you want to use that technology, it does support Time Machine because it's from Apple. But one thing to note is it only works, the Time Machine backups will only run when you're logged out of your account. So you either need to always remember to log out and leave your machine on, or set up some sort of automated process so that your machine is on and you're logged out so that the Time Machine backup can actually run. When I read that in the Tech Info article, and I'll have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com if you want to look into it further, I thought, well, doesn't that in some ways kind of defeats some of the advantages of Time Machine, which are the incremental backups. Typically, Time Machine will run every hour, every hour on your Mac and back up any changed files. So if you have to be logged out, you're obviously not going to log out every hour. So it's only going to pick up changes that happen between your logouts. So just something to know, but you will have the added security of knowing that your Time Machine backup is encrypted. So if your drive should fall into the wrong hands, you have a theft at your house or something unfortunate like that happen, you would be better protected. And a lot of people do worry about that data. But as I mentioned, in my case, I just encrypt specific disk images, and I don't have those open for very long or very frequently, so I don't worry about it too much. I would imagine that if that was mounted and I was accessing the files when Time Machine ran, that would get backed up in an unencrypted format, but I'm not entirely certain on that. I'll have to look into that a little bit further, but there's some other solutions if you want to have encrypted Time Machine backups. Another question that I often get when we start talking about backup is backing up to network-attached storage devices, NAS devices. And most often it's about, how do I back up from my Mac to the network-attached storage device? Well, I got an email this week from Steven who has sort of the opposite problem. He had a network-attached storage device and discovered that you can't, unless it's a time capsule, you can't back up using Time Machine. So he came up with a different solution for doing his backups, but now has this network-attached storage drive that he wanted to repurpose, decided to use it to store his iPhoto and iTunes libraries. So those are now on the network-attached storage drive, and that's working fine. But he wanted to know, how do I back those libraries up from the network-attached storage device to my locally connected Time Machine drive? Is that even possible? How could I possibly do that? Well, it turns out that Time Machine won't back up from a network attached storage device either. It only does from the internal volume, or volumes connected directly to your Mac. So we need a couple of other solutions. I looked into it a little bit. Some possible solutions. One would be to just manually copy the iTunes folder and the iPhoto library from the network attached storage device to a drive connected to your Mac, Stephen. That would be one way to go. You could script that process using something like Automator so that it automatically makes those copies every night, something like that, and then they would be picked up by the time by the regular Time Machine backup. Another way to go would be to use the built-in rsync functionality. That's part of the Unix underpinnings of Mac OS X. It's a command line tool that's available. It does require some pretty heavy terminal mojo, so if you're not up to doing that, it might not be a good solution for you. I know there are some WYSIWYG, you know, some editors and tools out there that you can get for the Mac, applications you can run to help you set up rsync. And rsync relies on remote login technologies built into the operating system, so you do have to go into your sharing preferences and turn on remote login or secure shell, which some people may or may not be willing to do. Bombitch, the company that makes Carbon Copy Cloner, actually has a lot more information on how to set this up, including how to build the latest version of rsync on your Mac. I'll have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com if anybody wants to look into that. But as I mentioned, it does require knowing quite a bit about the terminal and how to navigate around in that environment. Somewhat related to that, Carbon Copy Cloner itself uses a lot of technologies similar to rsync, or actually rsync for some of its underlying functionality and things that it does. And so the Carbon Copy Cloner application actually has a built-in tool that would allow you to do remote backup or cloning of a network detached storage device. Again, you have to turn on the remote login functionality, but it gives you a little installer when you enable the functionality, and it allows you to back up to a sparse image bundle over the network. If you do that, you lose the ability that Carbon Copy Cloner has to make a bootable clone backup. You'd actually have to take that disk image and basically clone it to another physical volume, and then you could actually boot from that. But the good news is that the whole process can be automated through the Carbon Copy Cloner application. So you might want to look into that method for doing it as well. The final way to go about it is to use a file syncing application, and there's lots of them out there and available. Something that would actually just have a scheduler where you could set up copying over the network the iPhoto library and the iTunes library from your network attached storage device to a local drive connected to your Mac that would be picked up by the Time Machine. My favorite syncing application is an application called ChronoSync. It's not free. It's about $40 US, but it does also have the ability to schedule backups and make bootable clones. So if you don't have a tool already for doing that, like Carbon Copy Cloner or SuperDuper, you could just pick up ChronoSync and have it do all of those different functions for you. I haven't played around too much with its backup and cloning functionality, but it certainly is in there. And the ChronoSync syncing technologies is really great, especially if you need to do things like keep folders synced between a couple Macs, maybe an iMac, a desktop, and a portable, or something like that. So it's well worth the money. You'll find some significant uses for it, even beyond just solving this network-attached storage and Time Machine issue that you're dealing with. So I'll have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com, and I hope that information helps you out. Very often related to a discussion about network-attached storage, or maybe hard drives that are connected to a shared Mac over a network, and just file sharing in general, people will ask me about the ability to auto mount a specific folder or volume when they turn on their Mac, meaning that when the Mac boots up, it will connect to a specific shared folder or volume that's on somewhere on the network. And got that question this week, and it turns out it's a pretty easy thing to set up in Mac OS X. All you have to do is go to the Finder and then go under the shared section, select the volume that you want to auto mount, and you'll probably have to click the little connect as button and enter a username and password that you would use for the remote volume. In that pop-up dialog that comes up, an important thing to remember for this trick to work is to check the checkbox that says remember this password in my keychain. You need to do that if you don't want to be prompted every time you reboot your Mac and it goes to auto connect. If you don't want to be prompted for the username and password. If you prefer for security reason to be prompted every time, you can go ahead and leave that unchecked, but check it if you don't want to be hassled. So after you do that and click OK, it should mount the volume. Go ahead and leave that mounted, and now you're going to go to the system preferences, and you're going to go into the accounts area and select your account. And then what you want to do is you want to click on the login items tab. And then in the pane that comes up there down toward the bottom, you'll see a little plus button to add items, to add new startup items. Go ahead and add a new startup item. And normally you might pick an application to start up automatically, but in this case, you're going to go ahead and navigate to that volume. And if you want to auto mount the volume, just select the volume. If it's a specific folder within that volume, navigate to that folder, select that folder, and either add the folder or volume to your startup items by clicking the add button. Once you've done that, you can exit the preferences, and now every time you reboot your Mac, it will automatically connect to that volume. If you chose to save your username and password to the keychain, it'll just auto mount. Otherwise, it'll probably prompt you for a login. You just enter your login, and that volume will be automatically mounted and connected. And that's how you do it. Pretty straightforward. And there you go. More and more these days, I think part of a comprehensive backup strategy, specifically when it comes to the area of archiving, is putting really important files up into the cloud, or at least off-site in some way. And cloud capabilities, putting it somewhere on a server on the internet, connected to the internet through some service, is becoming more and more convenient. It's easier to do. A couple of the services that I use, one is MobileMe and my iDisk, and the other one that we talk about a lot is Dropbox. And I think there's a reason that Dropbox is getting a lot of buzz, and I'll mention that in a minute. But Bob sent me a voicemail, or dropped us a voicemail on the hotline, and he wanted to let us know about a service that he uses and really likes.
Hi, Adam. It's Bob in Elizabeth, Colorado. Long-time listener to MacCast, and I really appreciate it. I wanted to cover a couple things with you. I know you're kind of like I am, a freak about backup, but I hear an awful lot of buzz and talk about Dropbox, and everybody seems to be wooed by Dropbox. And I've been using a service and an application from an organization called SugarSync. It's all one word, sugarsync.com. Actually found far cheaper and superior to Dropbox in terms of what it can support. Cross-platform is phenomenal, like most people. I use a Mac personally, have an iPad, iPhone, all things Apple. But at work, of course, I have a PC. I'm in a typical corporate environment where I have to cross. And SugarSync is a terrific way, with me being a road warrior, that I can keep all of my devices in sync. And I think it's fantastic. From a backup strategy, I do use a terabyte external drive that I've partitioned. I know you're not a fan of that, but I tend to be. I've partitioned into two 500 gig drives, one of which is a Time Machine backup, one of which is just a 500 gig external drive that I can use to put my various files on. Then at my home network, I have various external drives plugged into a network storage device that, when my Mac is at home, it does regular routines of carbon copy cloner to keep it to that external drive. And then finally, with SugarSync, I keep those files that are most critical to me up in the cloud. I would say, you know, in my experience, people go over the top with backup strategies in terms of what they really need to back up. To me, the files that I deem the most critical are, you know, scanned copies of the mortgage, life insurance, that sort of thing, that I make sure is in the cloud and absolutely protected. But the other items, like my iTunes library and et cetera, it would be a drag if that were lost, but certainly not the end of my existence on this planet if I lost a few of my songs or a couple of movies. So those items I typically keep in, you know, a couple of different external drives that are one always with me and one at the house. And if they got lost in the fire, that would be a drag, but that's what I have insurance for. I can replace all of those with insurance. So just thought I'd share, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on SugarSync and that type of service. Thanks again, Matt. Adam, I love the MacCast.
Hey, Bob, thank you for sharing. I really appreciate you bringing this discussion up, because I think you're right. I mean, Dropbox is not the only service out there. It maybe isn't even the best service. I think one of the reasons it's become very popular is the company has done a really good job of integrating with a number of third-party iOS apps. And I don't know how much SugarSync is doing that. I know SugarSync has a iPhone iOS application available, just like Dropbox does. Another service out there that's really pretty good that people should know about is Box.net. I think Box.net is attacking the corporate environment a little bit heavier than Dropbox. Dropbox seems to have more of a consumer push, but all great services, and I'm sure there's a few others out there that some of you are going to bring up after hearing this conversation. But certainly a good point. I don't think it really matters what you're using, and somewhat related to that, you bring up the point of not needing to back up everything necessarily or being more selective about your backups, especially when it comes to cloud-based storage. And I think that's important because it does take a long time to back up to the cloud. So if you're putting large files up there, you kind of do have to think about it a little bit more and become a little bit more selective. But I think you brought up another good point, which is, and I've mentioned this in the past, that backup is very personal. You have to do, part of the backup process is doing an assessment and saying exactly, going through that thought process that you mentioned. What is most critical to me? Now, in my case, you know, I look at my investment in my iTunes music, and it's a significant investment, and I wouldn't want to lose it. But I agree with you, it wouldn't be the end of the world, and my insurance probably would cover it, and I could repurchase that stuff. But remembering what I had and rebuying that stuff, it just seems easier to use something like CrashPlan, which is cloud storage, and I just let it throw those files into the cloud. It happened automatically. I didn't have to think about it. It took a long time, but those files are there now, and now I don't have to worry about them. So if I have a fire, I can get them back. Again, getting them back even from the cloud is going to be a little bit of a hassle, but I have that stuff, and I now have that option. In your case, your disaster recovery is going to be a little bit different, but it's just as valid a way of getting your music files back. And there's other solutions as well. I think the important thing to take away from this is that you do have to do that assessment, and you're going to have to decide. I can tell you, my decision is typically how easy is that to recover, or do I have that backed up in some other fashion, or do I have another way to get back at that? In your case, rebuying them with your insurance money. That's a valid way to get your audio files back. In my case, I look at software. I don't back up my applications that I have installed on my system because I figure I can always go back. I can download those applications. I can reinstall those apps. I do that regularly anyway, so it's not that big of a deal to me. Other people might not want to lose their applications. Maybe they don't have backups of that stuff. They don't want to deal with the hassle of having to go out to websites and re-download all those applications, and they're going to choose to back that up. So different strategies, different methodologies, but what's really great, as you pointed out, is we have all of these different options and services. We can make our own assessment and make our own choices and figure out what works for us. So like Bob, I encourage you to send in your email. Let us know what your solution is, and we'll be happy to share it. A great place to post this information too is on the MacCast forum. If you go to forum.maccast.com, you guys can share thoughts and ideas on different networking and backup strategies in general, and probably a good conversation to have over there. It's probably already happening. I need to pop back in there and see, and I would encourage you to do that as well. Received a couple emails and questions this week about iPhoto 11 and fixing some issues a couple of you are having. Justin mentioned that he was having issues with jittery or slow scrolling, specifically after applying the 9.1.1 upgrade. He said that he hadn't been having any issues since iPhoto 11 was released. iPhoto 11, just because it gets confusing, is version 9, iPhoto version 9. So just remember that as we're having this conversation. I flop between the two and often forget that it's not really clear. But I had been actually personally having issues with scrolling since iPhoto 11 came out. It was one of my complaints when I first installed it that even though my library isn't that large, I have about 7,500 images. I know people with libraries much, much larger than that, including my wife, whose library I think is at about 60,000. Just been having issues where the scrolling seems like it stutters. It's not that smooth, the motion itself, and I hadn't been really happy with it. So because Justin sent me an email, I decided to try and see if I could find a fix or solution. The one thing that I did that helped a little bit was to rebuild the thumbnails and rebuild the iPhoto library, which you actually can do. Not many people know about this, but if you hold down the Command and Option key while launching iPhoto, it will pop up a window and it will give you several choices. The specific ones that I chose were to repair the iPhoto library database, to rebuild the photo's small thumbnails, to rebuild all of the photo thumbnails, and it does note in there this will take a while, and I have a note on that here in a second. And then the fourth option I picked was to examine and repair the iPhoto library permissions. So I picked those four options. I think there's a couple others that are in there. I will give you the caveat that make sure you have your iPhoto library backed up, fully backed up before you try this process, just in case anything goes wrong. It shouldn't. It's pretty safe to do, but have that backup. And then I let it run, and it did, because I picked that one option where it said it might take a while, it did take a long time, about 2.5 hours to rebuild those thumbnails. And as I mentioned, I only have a library of about 7,500 images. Result, it did seem a little bit faster in the scrolling, but it wasn't a vast improvement. I still kind of get some jittery response. So I was playing around with it a little bit more, and I found out that if I adjust the zoom size with the little slider down at the bottom and had it display fewer previews, in other words, larger preview images on both the thumbnail screen and on the events screen, that the scrolling performance actually seemed to go up, which to me seemed a little counterintuitive at first because you've got bigger images. But I have a feeling that some of the scrolling performance is related to kind of the caching of the images and how many images are being displayed on the screen. I think it's having to render a lot of thumbnails, and because I believe it generates only kind of one thumbnail size or limited thumbnail sizes, it's still loading some pretty large images. And if you have a lot of them on screen, I think it's slowing the scrolling down. I noticed that if I scrolled slower, it would be smoother, but if I tried to scroll real quickly, it sort of would stutter and jump. It was like it would be smooth to a point, and then I think it would get to the point where it kind of had to catch up and start loading more of those images, and that would slow the scrolling down and cause that jittering or jumping. I'm not really sure. It didn't seem to be related to any kind of disk access or CPU or GPU performance issues. A lot of people think, oh, I don't have a fast enough Mac, or maybe there's higher end requirements, but I've noticed that the scrolling issue even exists on some of the latest Macs with the latest GPUs and CPUs and stuff like that. Even more memory doesn't seem to help. So I really think this is something that Apple's ultimately going to have to address. I don't think there's a magic fix out there for it, but maybe I missed something. So if you know of a way to resolve the kind of jittery scrolling, let us know. Otherwise, I think we're going to be waiting for Apple to issue an update or a patch, and hopefully that will come soon, because that is one area I haven't been impressed with the new version of iPhoto, is kind of some of the performance that's going on. Another complaint that I had seen with the new version of iPhoto has been related to photo sorting, and specifically photo sorting when importing from some digital cameras. That was supposedly fixed in the latest update, and I know a couple of you mentioned that it did fix some of the sorting issues for you, but I did have at least one listener who mentioned that with their Nikon, they were still importing photos, and in the events area, the events weren't showing up in the proper order when sorted by date. Now, normally you have the option to sort by date and by title, and then what you can do is you can manually move events around, and that sort of switches to the manual sort view. At that point, you should be able to sort between the three different views within the sort options and have it maintain that. For some reason, it seemed like the manual sort was causing some events to kind of stick in position, and then even though you had switched over to the sort by date option, it would still bring in the events and leave those manually sorted events in place, causing it to look like the sort order was off or wrong. So the fix that I suggested to this listener and seemed to have worked was to kind of reset things. Just so you know, if you go through this process, it is going to wipe out any manual sorting you had in place. So if you like your manual sorting, you may not want to try this trick, but it did work for this one listener. So if you go under the view menu and you look under sort events, when you're in the sort by title or sort by date option, there should be an option to reset the manual sort. If you select that option, let it reset the manual sort, and then go back to the sort by date and then do your import from your camera, it should put everything back to zero, and then you can can kind of work from there. And it, like I mentioned, it did work for this one listener. He was able to fix his sort by date options in the events view. So you might try that out. Again, if you have another fix or have another solution for this, please let us know. You can send feedback to maccast@gmail.com. And then finally today, this is a little bit of an odd one, but it comes up from time to time. I received this question from Kyle, who had a strange noise coming from his Mac.
Hey, Adam, this is Kyle, longtime listener, first-time caller, and I recently wanted to take up podcasting, and I refereed an old Mac to use just for recording, and I went to go shut it down one day, because I'm not the person that keeps it on all the time. I went to go shut it down, and I hear this long beep. It was about a two-second kind of beepish, tone-ish thing, and it was weird, and it happened for a week, every day for a week. And I don't know if you've heard anything about this. It's just, it shuts down, beeps, and the light goes off. And then I turn it back on, and it's all normal. Nothing's slow, nothing's fast. It's just the exact same thing was. Thanks, love the show. Bye.
Thanks, Kyle. You know, I think I know what this is, but I could be wrong, because typically the tone that you're describing is heard when you start up the Mac, not necessarily when you shut it down. There is something on Macs called the power on self test, post tones. And these are typically related to memory or RAM issues. Apple actually has a support article. Oftentimes they're accompanied by, if you have an LED button up on your power, so like the little white light that's on the front of the MacBooks and MacBook Pros, or the power button that's lit up on the front of a desktop Mac, something like that, it will also flash in conjunction with those tones. And depending on which model you have, they can mean different things. But most often, the single tone like that for a couple seconds means that the RAM is not installed. And then three quick tones usually means that the RAM isn't passing its integrity checks. So a common fix for this is to reseat the RAM, and especially if you had a Mac that was in storage for a while and then you brought it back out, just like setting it down on a desk, if it's a little bit harder, if it's jostled, or just even moving it around, might just pop the RAM out enough that it's not seated properly. So I would open up the Mac and just pop the RAM back in, and that probably will fix it. I'm curious, because you mentioned it went away, I'm wondering if maybe you moved the Mac again and just again setting it down may have seated the RAM enough where it's not triggering the tone to happen. But again, I haven't heard of this happening on shutdown. It's typically on boot up. The only other time I think you would hear a tone like this is maybe when you're doing a firmware upgrade. If you've applied a firmware patch, usually you have to restart the Mac and hold down the power key for a couple seconds. And when you're holding that power button down, it will cause that tone to happen. So maybe a faulty power button, something like that, but I don't think that is in the case. I would imagine that reseating your RAM will likely resolve the issue. Could be that the RAM went bad also and you may need to replace it. So those are a couple things to try. If you have another suggestion for Kyle, I welcome your emails. If you've run across this issue before, this weird tone on an older Mac, and that's going to do it for this episode. Thank you for listening. Before we leave, I do want to thank all of my show sponsors, Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You can get information on their products and information about their new iPad app over at circusponies.com. Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label. You can check out all their stuff, get more information and free trials over at smilesoftware.com. And Pharonix, makers of Deep Freeze and PowerSafe Mac. Check out their applications, get information and trials over at pharonix.com. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. If you have any feedback for me, anything you want to let me know about, a question, comment, you can send your emails to maccast@gmail.com or call in on the listener hotline, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. If you could just leave your email address and spell it out for me, that's always greatly appreciated. Also, be sure to check out the maccast.com website. There you'll find show notes with links to anything that I talked about in this or any other episode of the MacCast. And you can also check out the MacCast forum. That's at forum.maccast.com. You can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast, or on Facebook, facebook.com/themaccast. don't have any new music for you this week. I hadn't had time to go out and search anything out. I will say that I'm always looking for PodSafe music, new music that I can play on the MacCast. I welcome your suggestions, recommendations. If you know somebody, if you're in a band yourself and I can play your music on the show, please send me an email, maccast@gmail.com. The one thing I'll let you know about that is I do need to have permission from someone in the band or a manager or somebody that has the authority to allow me to play it on the show, just due to music licensing and how that all works. So if you don't have that, if you could get me in contact with someone within the band to get that permission, that is greatly appreciated. And hopefully I'll be able to spin that on a future episode of the MacCast. That's going to do it for today. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.